Okay, lecture two. Any questions about the mechanics of the course? You see, we have explained everything very well on the website. Okay, good. So, we were concerned with our task for the next couple of months of figuring out how to make two E. coli cells out of one. There's our logo. It's not really working too well. The pointer. I guess we can't turn the lights down. And we, first of all, if we're going to make a new E. coli cell with this 5,000 molecules, so the task can be couched in terms of what is it that we have to make. So we need to know what's in the E. coli cell. We're going to march through these 5,000 molecules. And along the way, however, to make it a little more interesting and make a story out of it, we're going to tell you what these molecules do. So that's why it's going to take us so long. What they're like, what are their characteristics, their special characteristics, and what they do. And sometimes what they do is very complex and extensive, and will take a couple of lectures to go through some of these operations. So we're going to combine these two things. The course as a whole does try to make, for the most part, a story out of this. So we start with water, as we have, and we built our way up to all the things, at least, that the cell does, and to some extent, as we get into genetics, what the whole organism does. Most of the whole organism material is in the second semester. Right? And so we had this hierarchy that's carefully designed to build up the story from how water works to how small molecules work and large molecules, and then the whole cell and what the problems are and how they're solved. And ending sort of at one stage with the information and the DNA. So that becomes a culmination. So we had started our discussion of our first molecule, which is really an unusual one. It's the most abundant one, water. We talked about how, because of the different electronegativity of the two atoms involved, oxygen and hydrogen, which sometimes occurs in molecules and sometimes does not, that we have a polar molecule. And because of this polarity, that was actually shown here on graphic two, because of this polarity, that we can have interaction between neighboring water molecules in liquid, as we show here in graphic three. And this interaction, when it involves a hydrogen, is called a hydrogen bond. And for these hydrogen bonds to be effective, they have to be close to a straight line between the three atoms that are involved, the oxygen and hydrogen that are held together with the covalent strong bond, and then this weak interaction between this delta plus and delta minus electrical forces. So that's a hydrogen bond and is in a category of a weak bond. And we'll hear more about that categorization in a little while. But just to how this weak interaction between water molecules influences the behavior of this kind of material is very striking, because this is molecular weight water of 18, right? 18 Daltons, 18 atomic weight units. And we take another molecule that doesn't show this kind of behavior, for instance, methane, which is just a carbon with four hydrogens attached to it, like this, all at equal distances. Carbon and hydrogen have about the same electronegativity, so they share the electrons equally. There is no separation of charge. There are no delta pluses, delta minuses, and no electrical interaction between methane molecules. So about the same weight, and at room temperature, water is this nice slippery liquid, and at room temperature, methane is this gas, and it doesn't become liquefied until you go to like minus 130 centigrade, something like that, right? So these electrical forces are holding the molecules together. Molecules are jumping around. Their bonds here are very transient affairs, and no sooner do they break one bond to this molecule, they'll make it with another. So this is a snapshot, say, of four water molecules at a given moment in time that will have changed partners in another millisecond. But as a whole, and overall, they are making all these interactions. There's a lot of them going on in a glass of water, and water stays a liquid. if you increase the molecular motion of these molecules by raising the temperature, temperature is the molecular motion, by adding heat, therefore raising the motion and therefore the temperature of your glass of water, when you get hot enough, then these hydrogen bonds are no longer sufficient to hold it in a liquid, and it joins it joins the behavior of methane and just goes into a gas. So water boils at 100 degrees centigrade, and the molecules go off in gaseous phase at that temperature. They're just moving too fast for this weak bond to have an effect. And conversely, if you drop the temperature, the motion gets slower and slower until the weak bonds are enough to actually immobilize the molecules. It's no longer a snapshot, but they lock them in to a relationship that's static, relationship of all the water molecules in the glass, and the glass is a glass of ice, right, a crystal. So between 0 degrees and 100 degrees, which is roughly what we find here on Earth, water is a liquid. And so we can have all this aqueous chemistry that goes on and forms the basis of life. Now, if water can do this, can other compounds do it as well? Okay, a little lag here. How about one of my favorite compounds, ethanol? It's got a hydroxyl group. That's our first functional group, remember, as well. But instead of a hydrogen on one end, it's got two carbons, CH3CH2. These should be subscripts. Carbons always takes four bonds. If I don't put in the four bonds, you can fill them in yourself. So here we have, it's an alcohol. Alcohols have hydroxyl functional groups on the end of them. This could be ethyl alcohol, sometimes it's called that, or shorter, ethanol. And it has, therefore, because it has the O and the H here, it has delta minus and delta plus, and so we can form interactions with water as well. If you mix ethanol and water, as I often do, you will find that the ethanol is perfectly soluble in the water because it interacts with it. The ethanol molecules get surrounded by it, or water molecules be surrounded by ethanol molecules if you make your drink really strong. Then we might ask, if less familiar organic compounds, so I'm introducing these functional groups that I asked you to memorize, remember. This is probably the most complicated one to introduce right away. And I'm introducing chemical nomenclature and abbreviation. So for instance, this is one whole functional group. It's called an amide, and it has these five atoms in it. And you can't separate into two parts, like the C double bond O group, which has its own name on your list of functional groups. And the NH2 has its own name, which we'll get to as we bring them up later in this lecture. But when they're arranged in all like this, it takes on a character of its own. It's the amide. And once you start breaking it apart, it's become something else. So you have to consider it as a whole. And this is the rest of the molecule, indicated R for rest or remainder, that we're not talking about. So we just write it down here as an R instead of having to make up an ethyl group or a propyl group or a certain number of carbons. It's faster. So this can also interact with water really in spades here, because you got all of these. You have five different partially charged groups on this amide molecule. So it's a very polar compound and is able to interact with water as well. So you notice here that because the N and the H have these delta plus and minuses, we can deduce that they have a different electronegativity, that the nitrogen is more electronegative than hydrogen, just as oxygen was. And I don't remember, and I don't want you to worry about, why is it more electronegative, because that's a subject for chemistry, and this is biology. So, but the fact that it is important, because it has this, because it becomes then a polar compound like ethanol or water, and is soluble in water. So there's our amide group. And instead of having to write out the whole structure, we could write it out like this, CONH2. This does not imply, any more than H2O implies that the two H's are connected to each other. This kind of abbreviation gives you no information about what atoms attach to what. You just have to memorize that from what the amide group looks like. Looks like this, right? So we squeeze it all together, we can write it down in the middle of a sentence without having to take up a lot of space as CONH2. We do this with a number of the more complicated functional groups. Sometimes we write it like this, if we're just sort of talking about it generally. If you want to talk about particulars, we draw out the structure. Well, since ethanol and this amide are both polar groups, couldn't they interact with each other? Forget about the water. Yeah, why not? So if you have a solution of ethanol and you put this amide in it, it would be soluble as well, and you form hydrogen bonds between the appropriate hydrogen donors, you know, or hydrogen acceptor here. Oxygen on the ethanol, the hydrogen of the ethanol could go to the oxygen, make a hydrogen bond to the oxygen of another amide molecule up here. Right. Trouble is, since most of the chemistry in life takes place, not all, but most of it takes place in aqueous solution, you usually have a large excess of water. Our bodies are about 65-70% water by weight, and by molarity it's even more, since water is very small molecular weight. So lots of molecules of water, by far more molecules of water than anything else in your body. So these are generally, organic compounds usually surrounded by water, so they this kind of interaction would be competed by water, and it would tend not to form very much, except in certain circumstances where these two groups might be sequestered, held together, and we'll see those situations arise. Then this kind of polar interaction, this kind of hydrogen bonding between two organic molecules, can become important. And just to so you don't get the idea that any two organic molecules I'll write down can interact, we can consider octane, which is named for its eight carbons. That's gasoline, the principal component in gasoline. And that carbon and hydrogen have about the same electronegativity, and so that like methane, there's no, it's not a polar group, it's an apolar or nonpolar group. And if you put that in water, there is no interaction, and indeed, oil and water don't mix. So gasoline and water would form two separate phases with the lighter gasoline on top. Now, having introduced this one weak bond, I'd like to talk about bond strengths in general and to talk about all the weak bonds that we're going to be talking about. Why should we bother with these weak bonds? It is, in fact, the weak bonds that define life in the sense of its special chemistry. Strong bonds are a dime a dozen. You find them in the rocks. They're very strong, hold together, hard to break up a rock. The weak bonds give all the subtlety and sophistication that's necessary for those three characteristics of living things. And so we're going to spend some time first, although I generally like to introduce concepts as we go along, as I have for the hydrogen bond and water, I find it convenient now to go through our list of weak bonds, and then when we meet them in real situations, we'll hopefully remember how they work. First, we'll start with the strong bond, which is really just one, and that is the covalent bond. And that's those single lines between the atoms, the shared electrons. So when I say strong, let's try to put some numbers on it. They're not really precise numbers, but we can say about 100 kilocalories per mole is the range for covalent bonds. What does that mean in terms of energy? That's the energy it takes to break that bond. That's how we can define the strength of bonds. How much energy do you have to put in, one way or another, to pull apart two covalently bonded atoms? And that's about 100. It could be 60, it could be 190. It's in the range of 100. And that's considered strong. And those bonds don't break unless there's a specific chemical reaction or unless you take the molecular motion way past 100 degrees centigrade up to 700 degrees centigrade. You know, things start burning and breaking apart because of the very high temperature. So it's hard to break these covalent bonds unless you have a specific chemical reaction. You trade one bond for another, and we'll talk a lot about that. Not right now, though. Now we've already introduced our first weak bond. The other thing is the units. We talk about kilocalories per mole. What's that? First of all, the mole is that we have a certain amount of energy. It's like per molecule, except it's convenient to talk about Avogadro's numbers worth of molecules or a mole. So that just normalizes the amount of material we're talking about. So if you have a mole's worth of ethanol bonds and you want to break apart those two carbons, it'll cost you about 100 kilocalories if you have a mole of them. What is a kilocalorie? Well, what's a calorie? Calorie is, and it's just defined this way to give a nice round number, it's the amount of energy needed to raise a gram of water 1 degree centigrade.
Right.
So a gram of water is usually about 1 cc, cubic centimeter, or 1 milliliter, synonymous. 1 milliliter of water, 1 degree centigrade. That's just a definition. Now, a calorie with a capital C is 1,000 little c calories. And that's the dietary calorie. So otherwise, the numbers would be too high for how many calories you get from a loaf of slice of bread. A kilocalorie is 1,000 little calories also. So a kilocalorie is the same as a big C calorie. And it's more reasonable to talk about kilocalorie than keep talking about little C calories and big C calories. So scientists use the kilocalorie and not the dietary calorie. So here's our hydrogen bond as our first weak bond. And water is a good example. Organic water or even organic. Basically, any two compounds that have polar functional groups on them can avail themselves, and a hydrogen, avail themselves of hydrogen bonding. So what other types do we have? How about ionic bonds? So we talked a little bit when I introduced the hydrogen bond last time. I said it's only a partial charge separation. It's not a full charge separation. And as an example of full charge separation, there's the ubiquitous sodium chloride. So where the chloride has such strong electronegativity, it takes the electron into its outer shell permanently. You get the full loss or capture of an electron, a full charge separation of one electron unit. So, if you have a crystal of salt from your salt shaker at your dinner table, it consists of crystals in which the chlorine has the extra, chloride ion has the extra electron, and the sodium is missing one electron. And that they hold on to those electrons or stay away from those electrons, in the case of sodium, and now you have a great big electrical charge between the two, which holds them together. And indeed, that's a very strong bond in a crystal of salt. Because if you try to break it, what does it take? I mean, suppose you had a big crystal of salt, you know, that you slowly crystallize, like the way you did with rock candy, right? You can't just, you know, tear it apart with your hands. You'd have to take a hammer to it, take it out on the sidewalk, smash it into a powder. So ionic bonds in crystals are very strong indeed, like covalent bonds. But you can much more easily separate the sodium from the chloride if you just take one of those crystals of salt and drop it in your glass of water. Then all of a sudden, the crystal is gone. What happened to all those strong bonds? In the presence of water in this aqueous environment, the water can interact with its partial charges together with the full charge on the chloride ion and with its oxygen delta negative partial charge with the positive charge on the sodium ion. So the two ions just become completely surrounded by these jumping water molecules, can't get back together again. And so effectively, in an aqueous solution, the attraction of the sodium for the chloride is pretty much nullified, and it's reduced to the status of a very weak bond. Right? Still somewhat stronger than the hydrogen bond, about 5 kilocalories per mole, as we'll see. So in water, which is what we're concerned with, the ionic bond is considered a weak bond. What do we call that interaction then? Maybe a nomenclature problem, because the hydrogen bond has the hydrogen, but there's no hydrogen on the chloride or the sodium. So we give it a name like a polar interaction, kind of a vague but accurate description, or an ion dipole interaction. The water is the dipole, has the positive and negative ends, right? And the ion is just an ion. It's either fully negatively charged or fully positively charged. So these are the terms here. So you see the bonds don't always fall into neat categories. So this morning, I didn't get so far because I told a few stories. At this point, trying to guide you as to what to look for, how to approach the material. And I was inspired by two questions I got after the first lecture. Both were very good questions, and they were showed the students were really thinking. And in case any of you are in the audience, right? So the first question was, when I talked about you can make a whole new E. coli from glucose, I said, well, that's not really accurate, right? Because you can't just make it from glucose, because you have other molecules that have nitrogen in them, for example, and phosphorus in them, and have all these other salts. So it's always glucose plus these salts. And this is, of course, true. And he wanted to make sure it just wasn't an oversight. You know, it was not an oversight. It was a certain poetic license on my part, because I wanted to say, you can make a whole new E. coli from glucose, to my father-in-law, right? Because that's what amazed me. So I knew glucose was the only source of carbon, and most of the 5,000 molecules are distinguishable one from another. The first thing you see is that the arrangements of carbons are different, and they're mostly made of carbon. And so I made this generalization somewhat inaccurate, right? Because I wanted to emphasize the point. If I had to keep saying you can make a whole E. coli from glucose and ammonium chloride and potassium phosphate, and it would be more accurate, but it would have less impact. Right? So I apologize in advance for certain inaccuracies that are there for the purpose of getting a point across. Right? But if you have a question like that, then you have to raise it. If it bothers you, you have to raise it, and then I'll set you straight. So my answer was, you know, cut me some slack. Didn't seem to satisfy the student. Neither did satisfy answer to the second student satisfy him. Three characteristics of living things. What about viruses? You know, so we haven't studied viruses. Dr. Mashers will talk about viruses. So viruses have some of these characteristics, but since they're very dependent, they can't live by themselves, they have to always use a living thing to grow in. Is it just a little piece of a few molecules of protein and DNA? Or so is that alive, or is it just a little package of dead stuff that the cell sort of makes alive, right? Well, that's the kind of, you could debate that question. You could debate it in front of a roaring hearth and an armchair over a beer in a bar. And it's, I guess, sort of an interesting question after the second beer. But to me, it's not such an interesting question, because it presupposes, you see, that kind of thinking presupposes, that's why I'm putting it in here, is that we scientists who say, well, this is this and that is that, and we make our lists, as I'm making lists all the time, we put things into categories. And then nature, what does nature know about this? Nature doesn't care about our categories, doesn't care about our particular English words that we can use to try and explain nature. So nature is full of like certain ambiguities, and something like a virus, well, in some sense, it could be considered logically alive. In some sense, you could argue against that. And in the end, what's the difference? We know what's living. By the time we go through the processes, we see all the things that are involved in what's in these characteristics of living things, and whether a particular piece of nature falls neatly into one or neatly into another category or falls in between, as long as we understand it, it shouldn't bother us that we can't define it. So what I'm saying is you have to understand what's going on. If you understand what's going on, that's the point. And if you study in such a way as to have all these definitions, then you're going a little bit along the wrong track. Right? So that's why I give my little speech here. Right? So here's an example, is polar interaction. So it's not exactly one or the other. It doesn't fall neatly into a category. But we already understand it. We understand why it's there, right? Okay, so ions, but ions understand we have all these salts in the E. coli's minimal medium, but what about the organic compounds themselves? Can they become ions, or are they only polar? No, they can be ions. And the only ions we'll talk about, the ions we'll talk about most, are the acids and the bases. And these are defined as compounds that either lose a hydrogen ion or take up a hydrogen ion. Right. So the hydrogen ion is just a proton. First, let's talk about acids. And the main acid we'll talk about are the carboxylic acids. And there's our one, two, third functional group. We have the hydroxyl, the amide, and now the carboxylic acid. And here it is written out in its condensed form without showing you what's attached to what. COOH attached, or it should be maybe an R here. It's not off into space. So acids we define as losing a proton. And if we start with a carboxylic acid whose more detailed structure of COOH looks like this, with C double bond O and an OH. This is not a hydroxyl attached to a C double bond O. Again, the whole thing acts as a unit and has its own characteristic, and that's the carboxyl group, or carboxylic acid, as they're synonymous. Once it loses its hydrogen ion, because the electronegativity now is so great by this arrangement of two electronegative oxygen atoms pulling on that one shared electron of hydrogen, it's too much for the hydrogen, and you get this salt, essentially. So you get the negative ion with a full charge and the free proton divested of its electron. Right? So a compound that can do this in water here or anywhere is called an acid and results in an ion. Usually the ion has an ATE on the end compared to the acid. In general, carboxylic acid would have a carboxylate ion. Right? That's just nomenclature. And this is a hydrogen ion or a proton. Those are synonymous. If you have a neutral solution at pH 7, you notice there are double arrows here, because almost all these forms of changes that we see are equilibrium reactions. So there's a tendency to lose the proton, but the proton can also reverse and come back on. Almost all chemical reactions at the microscopic level are reversible. And sometimes you indicate that with a big arrow on top, say if the reaction tends to go to the right. These are things you learned in chemistry, right? So at pH 7, what does that mean? What is the hydrogen ion concentration at pH 7? Right? You all know. Just think somebody has to shout it out. What's the hydrogen ion concentration of a solution at pH 7? 10 to the negative 7. Okay. So under these conditions, that's not very much hydrogen ion to drive this backwards. And so about 99.9% of the molecules will look like this, and we say therefore the net charge on this acid is minus 1 at pH 7. We can change this, as we'll see in the future, by increasing the hydrogen ions. If we had another source of acid like hydrochloric acid, we could push it over this way. But at pH 7, where most biology goes on, this is essentially virtually all charged, although not completely. Here's an example, acetic acid. You can't tell much from the name in this case. Again, it's got the two carbons, which we just saw two carbons with hydroxyl. So I'm slipping in a lot of terminology here. We get used to talking about organic molecules. Was ethyl alcohol, the two carbons is ethyl group, ethyl alcohol, or ethanol, same thing. And this could be ethylic acid, but it's not called that. It's called acetic acid for historical reasons. Right? And that's the acid in, as you all know, in vinegar. That's one example. Now, how about, on the other hand, we have bases, or alkalis. These are the amines. So we have a new group here, in this case, NH2, the amine group. And amines have the characteristic of adding a hydrogen ion. If they meet a hydrogen ion, they will grab onto it and form four bonds to nitrogen to form a positively charged ion. Now, where in tarnation would they get this hydrogen ion from? In aqueous solution, you have water, right? HOH, right? Doing their dance. Where are the hydrogen ions going to come from? Anybody? What? From the water, right. You just told me that pH 7, which is neutrality for water, there is, in fact, 10 to the minus 7th molar hydrogen ions and 10 to the minus 7th molar hydroxyl ions are present in the equilibrium reaction. HOH goes to H plus and OH minus. So water is a very weak acid. It's mostly in the unionized form, but a little bit is ionized into OH and H plus, and in fact, 10 to the minus 7th molar is what you have. So you have hydrogen ions available, and indeed, as you keep adding them onto this base, if you add more and more of this RNH2, you keep soaking up these hydrogen ions, they're just going to be replaced by the equilibrium reaction of H2O goes to OH and H plus. So if you keep taking off the H pluses, pretty soon you're going to find you have an excess of OH minuses as the H pluses are pulled out to this amine. So if you add an amine to water, the pH will go up because the hydrogen ion concentration free goes down because they're all bound up to this amine. These two amines generally are moderately strong acids. So at pH 7, they would be positively charged 99.99 or more percent. Okay, so we have these ionic bonds, these ions, and they can then perhaps interact with each other. Here's our carboxylic acid forming, just like an NaCl, forming a bond to this amine. Something like that could happen. Just cursor out of the way. And again, this interaction would be thwarted to a large degree in water because same reason that the Na and Cl come apart in water, because the two ions are hydrated by these polar water molecules associating with them. Nevertheless, under certain circumstances, such bridges between positive and negatively charged organic molecules can take place, as we will see. So the ionic bonds are about 5 kilocalories per mole, and we can add them to our list. Here on graphic 14, a little bit stronger than the hydrogen bonds because the electrical charges are greater in this case. Strong in crystal, weak in solution. We have two more categories of weak bonds. The next one is the weakest of all, and they're called van der Waals bonds. And these are a little bit harder, but not that hard to understand. Let's consider any molecule. So any molecule has an electron cloud around its atoms, right? And this electron cloud has the electrons moving around it. And by chance, it could be that in 1 nanosecond, they have the electrons more on one side of the molecule than on the other side. So just transiently, you have a little bit of a dipole, just by chance. Right? Any molecule can do this. Any atom, right, will do this. That's called a fluctuating dipole. Now, if that molecule, which by chance, and during this nanosecond, finds itself very close to another molecule of any type, right? This negative charge, let's say it's this one, this negatively charged extra electrons here will force the electrons in the neighboring atom away because of electrical repulsion, right? And as a result, the neighboring molecule will become positively charged just at the surface that's interacting here. So it reinforces then the interaction between these two atoms just because of this fluctuation. And you sort of lock in this kind of bonding, this so-called van der Waals interaction after Mr. van der Waals. So these can take place between any two atoms, but they're very weak. First of all, 1 kilocalorie per mole, which is still not that much more weak than hydrogen ion, 1/3. But the problem is that you don't push these electrons off on the second molecule unless you are really very close. And the strength of this electrical interaction falls off at some high power of the distance. I didn't re-look it up this year. It's about the 4th power of the distance, I think, give or take 1. 4th or 5th power of the distance. So it falls off tremendously, like art of the 4th. And so it's only effective if the two molecules are really cuddling up. But once they do that, then you do have this very real interaction. So it's the kind of weak bond that's only effective at very short distances. And each one itself is weak, but if you have a lot of them at once, it can influence things. Van der Waals, it's van der Waals interactions that impose the greatest subtlety and specificity to biological, the interactions between biological molecules, as we'll see. So they are, in fact, very important also as we go along, as we'll see. So far, these are all electrical and all sort of understandable.
Yeah, they have to be about one angstrom.
If they get too close, they can't get too close. Once you get closer than about one angstrom, which is a tenth of a nanometer, you might recall, then the interaction between the nuclei of the two molecules becomes way too strong, and they just can't approach each other. So in fact, the van der Waals radius of a molecule is the closest distance of approach that they can have. And it's only at that, within a small window of that distance, that the van der Waals bonds are effective. So there's the van der Waals, close range only, graphic 16. Go to graphic 17, we introduce our last class, which is not a bond per se, but is a force that does hold molecules together, and a very ubiquitous and important one in aqueous solution of biological materials. So these are called hydrophobic forces. The energy is about 3 kilocalories per mole of each one of these. And it's a different kind of animal. To understand it, let me start with back to our octane molecule, which you remember has no polar character whatsoever. It's just C8H18, just carbons and hydrogens, right? Now, since we're going to go into an aqueous environment, what can these guys do? Well, they're not even soluble, right? Well, maybe a little bit. If we drop introduce these two terms. Nonpolar molecules that cannot hydrogen bond to water are said to be fearing of the water. Hydro water, phobic fearing, they're hydrophobic, right? The opposite of hydrophobic are the polar compounds, who just love to be in water. Hydro, water, philic, loving. Water fearing and water loving molecules. So we can characterize the molecules in this way. Some molecules are completely hydrophobic, like octane. Some are completely hydrophilic, like pretty much ethanol. And some are in between and can't be pigeonholed so easily. Now, consider one molecule of octane that ventures into your glass of water. It finds itself, there's nothing else there but water, so it finds itself surrounded by water. The water has no particular attraction for it. This is the hard part to swallow. It's not intuitive. The water, indicated by these little blue Vs that surround this octane molecule, a single octane molecule, are precluded from dancing with this partner, right? They're forming these hydrogen bonds with each other, but right around this little octane molecule, which could be considered even like a little cavity in your a little nano cavity in your water volume, right? They're precluded from that. And as a result, they take on a kind of an ordered structure compared to what they were before this interloper came in. Before that, they were just going this way. Now, they can go this way, but they can't really go that way. And the result is that they are more ordered, almost like a little cage around this, that's the word that's used, around this hydrophobic, non-interacting octane molecule. Now you put a second octane molecule in, same thing happens, right? These water molecules, compared to when the octane wasn't there, are more ordered. There is a law of thermodynamics that says the universe as a whole is going towards occupying more and more different states. This is just an effect of statistics and probability, that if there are more states out there, you will occupy them. When you have the two octane molecules in here, you have less possible states for the water to occupy than in its absence. And so that the entropy, or the disordered state, the higher number of states, I shouldn't really say it's disordered, right? Higher number of states is less. The entropy is increased, is decreased. The entropy is decreased. There's more order. So this is unfavorable, right? Because entropy should always be increasing. Now, in any given little system, like our walking bodies, we're going way against this rule. But it's okay, as long as the entropy of the universe is still increasing, it's okay. So the sun takes care of it, generating lots of entropy.
as it disintegrates slowly. And and so we can put in energy to work against this entropic factor. What can this glass of water do to maximize its entropy, given with the fact that the octane is there, has to live with it? Suppose these two octane molecules collide with each other. Now, at that moment, the water molecules at the inside interface, inside faces here, are displaced. They're out here now. If there were eight, which I'm making these up, these eight molecules of water around this octane molecule and eight around this one, then around the two together, there's only 10, and four have been displaced, right? No, 16. I don't know if it adds up. 8 and 8 should be 16. And then 10. There should be 6 displaced then. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10. Yeah, there should be then 6 because there were 16 to begin with. Okay. So these guys now are free to join the entropic dance. That they have increased their entropy is a favorable situation. So why should they ever go back? They don't go back. Because if they did this, if you just minimize the surface of your octane molecules so that you're ordering the least number of water molecules, then you're going to, given the fact that it's there, you're going to still maximize the amount of entropy that you have. This is not intuitive, right? And so the octane molecules will go together. Now we can observe this. If you put a few drops of gasoline into the water, they don't disperse around into, even if they don't interact over the whole surface, they glom together into a circle. Right? So what's holding them together in this circle? Yeah, you have some van der Waals, but van der Waals are everywhere. Right? It's more than van der Waals. It's stronger than van der Waals. It's hydrophobic forces. What are hydrophobic forces? They're these. This is what's holding them together. This is completely caused by, mostly caused by entropy, a change in entropy. Now, you might say, okay, these water molecules have increased their entropy, but what about the octane molecules? Here, they were free to be anywhere in the glass of water. Now they're constrained to be all together, these two and the next billion that you add. They're all together. Certainly that's not occupying all possible states in that beaker, right? So the entropy of the octane must have decreased. That certainly has to be true. So you have, I don't know how you predict, which entropic factor is greater, the disorder of the water or the ordering of the octane? Well, you just look at the result. It must be that the disorder of the water is more important than the ordering of the octanes, right? Because in fact, the octanes do stick together. So this is the basis. This is still 1959, so what? It's about 50 years later, still somewhat controversial as to whether this explanation I'm giving you is 100% correct. It's probably nothing I'm telling you is 100% correct. But this is pretty much the accepted. And it's underneath statements like attracts like, and which doesn't really explain anything. Right? And these hydrophobic forces play a big role in how living processes work, as we'll see. Oh, these are all the things I said already. On graphic 21 is what I said. Okay, looking back. And on graphic 22 is also what I just said, so I'm not following my slides exactly. And I kind of belabor it because I think it is a hard concept to grasp. Not like those little pluses and minuses and electrical attractions. Here's some artist renditions of some of this cage structures. Here it is where the hydrophobic molecules are separated. Here's a methane molecule, right, like this one here, surrounded by water molecules, a red oxygen and two small white hydrogens over on graphic 24. And here's, let's say, a much bigger molecule or perhaps a whole bunch of octane molecules surrounded by a bigger cage of water. So you get an idea of what's meant by by their having somewhat of a structure. This makes it a little bit more palatable, that the water has some kind of structure as it wraps itself around these hydrophobic cavities. Okay, so that's the end of the section on bonds, and as we go through, we'll bring up these bonds where they're playing a role. And it ends water. So now we can attack the other 4,999 molecules. And first, before we do that, we'll categorize them. Large and small. What do we mean by large? Greater than 5,000 Daltons. Dalton is a atomic weight unit. So 5,000 is pretty big. The large molecules are synonymously called macromolecules. Macromolecules and large molecules, same thing. And here's some examples that we'll be discussing. Proteins, we'll start actually with polysaccharides. And DNA, those are all large molecules. Then what are the small molecules? There is kind of a separation. Here's a pretty gray area. Most small molecules are 500 Daltons. That's 10 times less than the smallest large molecule. And there's lots of exceptions to these. When you see the structure of these, you'll understand. So there are very complicated small molecules that can get to be maybe 1,500 or 2,000 Daltons, but generally smaller than the large. Most of them are much smaller, about 50 atoms, let's say. Or, you know, one atom, like hydrogen. Hydrogen ion would be a small molecule. These small molecules are just called small molecules and not micromolecules or anything like that. And we've met several examples now. Water, ethanol, glucose. Acetamide wasn't named, but if we put... it was actually acetic acid that we talked about. Methane we talked about. Octane. These are all small molecules. Now, the way you get the large molecules is to take the small molecules and glom them together in covalent bonds. Attach a bunch of small molecules together with covalent bonds until it gets to be 5,000 or bigger. That's a large molecule. How can we do that? Here's an example of a synthetic large molecule, a polypropylene, which is a familiar plastic. It's that cloudy plastic. It's a little pliable and very strong. Or you can make ropes out of it, as we see on graphic 26. The small molecule that's used to make polypropylene is only made of this one small molecule all attached to one another. CH3CH, double bond CH2, and this double bond opens up and these things can now interact with each other. So how might that happen? Could it be like this? You could get like this fancy network of small molecules attached hither and thither to make a polymer of these small molecules. Or even more complicated in biological situations where the small molecules can be very different. So the large molecules in many macromolecules in the cell, like proteins and nucleic acids, they're not all the same, like propylene, right? But they have different colors. And there could be something like this, and it'd be very complicated. But thankfully, this is not the way they're attached. But we have one general principle for making small, large molecules out of small molecules, and that is that the large molecules are linear polymers of the small molecules. And that greatly simplifies our ability to understand them. So we now have to consider some nomenclature talking about these polymers. First of all, if you use a small molecule to make a large molecule, then that small molecule is a monomer of that polymer, right? The polymer is the long thing, right? If you put just two together, you just have a dimer, and you're still a small molecule. How about if you put three, you got a trimer, a tetramer, we could go on and on. As we get larger, we can't remember the prefixes, so we just call it a general term, oligomer. This is so we can communicate. An oligomer is something bigger than three or four. It's a matter of taste almost, but usually in context it's understandable. So that's also an oligomer. This one could be a hexamer, obviously. This one's 11. I don't know the name for that. They're both oligomers. Polymer, on the other hand, is much bigger. Right? So it's down here and winds around. Could be hundreds, thousands, millions. What's left of the monomer down here, so you can identify, this is a monomer of this polymer. So these are the words we'll use. So monomers are small molecules. Not all small molecules are monomers, however. There's plenty of small molecules that never engage in any shenanigans like this. They just don't go into polymers. And they have still some jobs to do in the cell. The macromolecules that are going to be made from the small molecules in the cell are of these four types: polysaccharides, lipids, nucleic acids, and proteins. And again, there are some molecules that will fall in between these categories, which we won't concern ourselves with in this course very much. And we'll start going through these. We'll talk about polysaccharides, then lipids. These will be relatively brief, although I'll use them to bring out some lessons about how molecular structure affects function. And then we'll just skip over nucleic acids to proteins and spend a long time on proteins. And finally, nucleic acids with Dr. Moshowitz. So if we consider what's inside the cell, we have to remember that logo, we want to know what we have to make. We certainly have to make all the monomers. We have to make these four macromolecule types, many different molecules in each type. And therefore, we have to make all the monomers that go into making those polymers. I'm using polymers and large molecules and macromolecules all synonymously. There's only about 50 of these monomers. To make all these things, there's only about 50. Maybe there's 80. I don't know. I could think of 50. Small number, relatively. Plus, there's about another 10 or 20 small molecules that are very important in the cell and are used for functions that we'll learn something about that are not monomers for polymers. They're small molecules. They have a special job. Let's do some numerology here. Well, wait, not ready for that yet. Consider the monomer for polysaccharide. Now, one common monomer for polysaccharide is glucose, which we've met before, as being present in minimal medium. So where do you get the glucose to make a polyglucose, which is, for instance, cellulose? How does a plant do that? Well, it's got the glucose, or how does E. coli do that if it makes a polymer of glucoses? It's got the glucose right in the medium. So no problem with that monomer. How about a protein? Polymer of protein, the monomers are amino acids. There's about 20 different ones. As you might expect from the name, they have an amino group on them. There's a structure of one of them called alanine, English word, doesn't help you know what it is, but here it is. It's got three carbons. It's got a carboxylic acid on one side, an amino on the other side, therefore amino acid. We'll talk more about it when we talk about proteins. The point I'm making here is that this small molecule monomer that goes into all proteins looks nothing like glucose. So where's it coming from? It comes from, has to be coming from glucose, because at least the carbons of it, the N is coming from the ammonium chloride, to be sure. It's coming from glucose, and it's ending up at something very different. It's going through a pathway, and this is a part of the metabolism of the cell. You take the E. coli, is going to take the glucose, change it into something that looks almost like glucose, but a little different, called A, and then something a little different from A that's called B, etc., etc. And finally, E, you have something that almost looks like alanine, and finally it gets changed to alanine. So by a series of small, discrete chemical changes, you go through a biosynthetic pathway from glucose, and we'll talk about how this is done with these arrows, and you end up with alanine. For this purpose, I'm just trying to give you an idea of how many small molecules there are in living things. So we know we need the alanines, representative of those 50 monomers. But now we see there are intermediates between glucose and alanine, which are also going to have to be present in the cell, even if transiently. Here's again this picture of the flow of material in our E. coli cells starting from glucose. And now we can put some names on these little red and blue balls. Finally, we end up with monomers on top in graphic 35, and all the balls in between are called intermediates. And most of the use of these intermediates is nothing more than a stepping stone on the way to the monomers. This is how it's working. So, we can make a very rough estimate. 50 monomers we have to make. There's about, let's say, 15 small molecules that aren't monomers. We also have to make them starting from glucose. Right? So there's 65 pathways
let's say. Each pathway, let's say, is conservatively, as the most it would be, is about 10 steps. Some are 15, but most are 5 or 6 steps. Let's say if there's 10 steps. So that means there's 9 intermediates in every pathway. If there's 65 pathways for all these small molecule end products, then we have 585 intermediates. If we add that to the 65 end products themselves, we get this very rough total of about 650 total types of small molecules, different from one another, types, right, that have to be made. That is not such a big number, considering we're talking about E. coli, and that for these small molecules, elephants aren't all that different. A manageable number. We know them all. So let's start with our first macromolecule. And as we bring up these macromolecules, the first thing we'll discuss is the small molecule monomers of which it is made. So polysaccharides are made from sugars. The monomers are called sugars. What is a sugar? A sugar is a small carbohydrate molecule. This does not help. What is a carbohydrate? Carbohydrates have general structure CNH2NO2. So in the old days, before they really knew what these structures were, they saw the composition of these elements in carbohydrates. So they said, here's a carbo part, and here's, looks like water, H2O, or many waters. Carbohydrate. So it's a historical name. More precisely, or more usefully, they're molecules that have almost always one C double bond O group and many hydroxyls. Right? That's characteristic of sugars. If you didn't have the C double bond O, you might call it like a polyhydroxy compound or a polyalcohol. Alcohol and hydroxy are the same. But once it has that C double bond O, it becomes a sugar. It gets more complicated and less precise because you can have other groups on these sugars. At some point in the molecule, you might have a carboxyl group or an amine group, still called a sugar. The most common sugar, the most common monomer in polysaccharides by far is glucose. And we'll start with glucose and just give a short discussion of other sugars. But we'll look at glucose in excruciating detail. The purpose for this excruciation is to start right away with the lesson that the structure of a molecule is related intimately to its function, or its function related to its structure. And it's hard to know where to start with our macromolecules. Polysaccharides in some ways are a bad place because the structure is pretty complicated. But any other particular place to start also has drawbacks. So we're starting with sugars. So what's the structure of this monomer glucose? This is the third time I'm showing you this. This is the glucose molecule, is carbons and hydrogens. And we'll take this opportunity to introduce some organic chemical nomenclature and abbreviations. First of all, if we want to talk about the carbon, say, that has the double bond O, I could say it's the top carbon, but I could have drawn this molecule upside down. It would still be the same molecule if I just swish it around and slide it around on the plane of the board. So it'd be better if we could put numbers on these things. So there is a numbering system in organic chemistry. And if you knew more organic chemistry, it'd be easier to explain. But I would just explain it by saying, if you have to choose one end for one, you choose the end that has the less hydrogens around it. In reality, this is the most oxidized carbon, which usually ends up being one that has less hydrogens attached directly or indirectly to it. So this all these guys have two hydrogens directly or indirectly attached to them. This one even has three. So we'll choose this one for number one. And now we can talk about the number five carbon, which we will in a minute. The number one carbon, the number six carbon, and we know where we stand. This functional group, C double bond O, what I've been calling C double bond O, because I haven't really introduced it, now we can call it by its real name, right? So a C double bond O is called a carbonyl. And the carbonyl functional group is further subdivided into two kinds of carbonyls, those that have a hydrogen attached to the carbon with the double bond O and otherwise carbons attached, and that's called an aldehyde. So that's a functional group also. If, on the other hand, the C double bond O is attached to a carbon that itself was attached to two other carbons, notice always four bonds to carbon, then, although I didn't put them in down here, right, then it's called a ketone. So a ketone is a carbonyl, an aldehyde is a carbonyl, and a carbonyl could be either an aldehyde or a ketone. So one is more inclusive than the other. The other functional group it has is our familiar hydroxyl by now. Now, it takes a long time to write all these carbons and hydrogens and oxygens down, so we can use a shorthand. And there'll be two levels of shorthand we'll discuss, one now and one when we talk about lipids, that's even shorter. In this case, since carbon is so common in these compounds, organic compounds, and hydrogen also is so common, that we take the liberty of just leaving those out, since we know there's always one bond to hydrogen, and there's always four bonds to carbon. We can just leave them out. If we leave them out, the convention is if there's nothing there, and if there's four bonds to it, or if there's two crisscrossing bonds, or if there's a vertex between bonds indicated by lines, that's carbon if it doesn't say otherwise. If it were nitrogen here, we'd have to write the N in. There's nothing there, it's carbon. Similarly, we have these bonds ending in space. There's no space there. If we don't bother to write the atom that's there, it's a hydrogen. So this molecule is exactly the same as this molecule because it has numbers on it. Now here's where things get more complicated. Because the structure of glucose is not this flat. First of all, it's not this flat thing. This is just a two-dimensional representation. So here's glucose. I got screwed up this morning, and I'm already in trouble here. Where's my C double bond O? Just popped off. That's all. Looking for my carbonyl there, aldehyde. So here's the aldehyde up at the number one position. You see, all the rest is all this crookedness because carbon projects its bonds if it's attached to four things. It projects them at equal angles, all one from the other. So if you filled in, put a plane across these outside, all these outside atoms, you'd build a tetrahedron, a four-sided solid. Right. So these are tetrahedral bonds, and we see the same thing here. Here's a hydrogen. Here's a hydroxyl. Here's an oxygen. And just as in the abbreviation, I didn't put a. We have things ending in space, there's a hydrogen there. Here's our C double bond O and a hydrogen, so it's an aldehyde. Around all of these single bonds, you have free rotation. I hesitate to do it in this old arthritic model. But you would have free rotation, one against the other. If you have a double bond, there's no free rotation. And if there are other constraints, as we'll see in a minute, there isn't. But around, so this thing can twist around and it can contort. Chemical reactions generally involve two molecules approaching each other with sufficient velocity such that their electrons kind of get merged. So you have two molecules zipping around in solution. They hit together. Some of the time, then, they will resolve themselves in a different way, and an atom of one gets transferred to one molecule, and this one loses an atom, and you have two new molecules. That's a chemical reaction. So generally, they're hard to do because they're hard to find each other. In this case, there is a reactive group. The C double bond O is pretty reactive. It's easily broken if it would find another oxygen. So if it had, say, this oxygen jumping around and hitting over here, but the trouble is, this is kind of far away, right? So it doesn't quite reach it. Right? If we take something a little closer, in fact, it's a little too close, so I can't sort of bend it. I mean, I could, but it would break it. So when you get down to the 1, 2, 3, 4, the fourth black carbon here, the oxygens are unfortunately different colors, right? You could actually
interact these two and form a little ring here. But this works even better without any strain whatsoever. If we look at the hydroxyl, the silver one, that's attached to carbon number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Bang. These are constantly just going to be banging into each other as this molecule comports. And so sometimes when these electron clouds interact, they will switch partners here. This double bond being attacked, essentially, will spring open, and this oxygen will attach instead of that oxygen. But this oxygen, previously free, has now formed this ring. And this oxygen, formerly in a double bond, this now has a hydrogen here. Where did he get it? Well, this guy gave it up. So the hydrogen that was on the end of this one went over here, and this one went over there. So this is all shown also on the right side of graphic 39. Right? So now we have a ring. This morning the whole thing fell apart, and I had to rely on my animation, which is maybe better anyway. One thing you can notice here is that once you form this ring, is that this new hydroxyl was just formed. Let's see. Usually we put, this is so-called Haworth view, with oxygen sort of away from you and on your upper right, right? So this, no, it's going to be like this. Let's see. No, I'm going to be in trouble here. There's the oxygen, right? So here's this new hydroxyl sort of sticking up or out, right? There's the oxygen of the ring. Here's the old number one carbon. This is the only carbon that could do this. This carbon that has the C double bond O that's attackable like this is called the anomeric carbon, has a special name. And only sugars that have this anomeric carbon can form these ring structures. So notice where this is. This is out here. So that's one molecule. This is sort of like this one here. This is a reversible process. So I look for where my springs are. I know where I am. So this whole process can be reversed, and we get back our original guy here, right? And then it can happen again. So it's going backwards and forwards. Not that fast, actually. I used to think it was fast. It's maybe a minute before you might, on the average, switch back to state change, switch to a ring again, right? And then it could happen again. Except this has two sides to it, right? Last time I took off this little red part. This time, I think I did. Better have. This time I'm going to make the change on the other side of the C double bond. What's the difference? Well, the difference is, I still put my oxygen up here. Whereas before, this yellow guy was over here. Now it's over here. Well, what's the difference? Well, it's different. I mean, if I had these two molecules, I couldn't superimpose one on the other. One has its new number one hydroxyl out here, and this one has. And I can't swivel it around to do that, because I can't swivel anymore around these single bonds, because they're all locked into this ring. So the ring locks the structure in. And it's actually a very compact structure, although it doesn't look like here. Notice this, because we went to the number 5 carbon, the number 6 is isolated out here, hanging off outside the ring. Let me show you the animation of the same thing, such as it is. Here's our glucose molecule in its abbreviated form. Now it's wiggling around, gets itself horizontal. Now it starts to circle around, just by chance. Finally, it gets to the point where it's poised to have this reaction. And then you have the reaction. Back one, you have it. See that OH popped right up on top, right? There's attack going on. Have it in color, make it easier. See OH? There's the OH with this red OH, right? There's the, that H changes its partner from the greenish one, or cyan, And now it's attached to the orange one. And somehow the oxygen got green from cyan, I don't know. And look where it is. It's up above the ring as it's depicted as this flat ring here. Although you see it's not really flat. And we'll get into that next time. Now, suppose we start this movie again. Except this time my purple arrow comes in from the other side, just as I did it here. Now the OH is on the bottom. So it's just all the same thing I just showed you in my rickety molecule, but maybe you can see this more easily. As a result, we get two different structures that are not superimposable. You can see that more easily here. Notice also that these hydroxyls are fixed. This one is always on top. If we write the oxygen back here, and we go around the ring in the right direction, so they're both comparable, this hydroxyl always is on top in this ring. This hydroxyl at number 4 is always on the bottom of this structure. It's only this one that's newly formed, this newborn hydroxyl that came out of the attack of the anomeric carbons, C double bond O, that has the flexibility to be either on top or on the bottom in this so-called Haworth projection. And so we have to give them different names. They're both glucose, but we call one alpha and one beta arbitrarily. So the one that's on the bottom is called alpha, and the one that's on the top is called beta. And they're distinguishable. They have very similar characteristics. They're all sweet. Here's another way to look at it. With balls and sticks on graphic 43. And this is interesting because it's a space-filling model. The first one I'm showing you was not balls and sticks where you can see what's attached to each other. It's much harder to see what's attached to what here. On the other hand, this gives you an idea of what the electron clouds, when you take the electron clouds into consideration, where's that space in the middle of this ring? It's non-existent. I mean, these electrons are all filled with electrons. Right? This is glucose, right, in the ring structure. And on graphic 44, I put the labels in, but it might be nice to test yourself to see if you can do it without the labels, tell what's what. This is just sticks with no balls. And one thing you can notice from this is that it's taking into account the fact that this molecule, as shown in the Haworth projection, is not a flat ring, but it's puckered. This kind of information in here is telling you what the position of the hydroxyl and hydrogen are relative to each other. Even in this Fischer projection, you notice it's not arbitrary where we put the hydroxyls. And this is a hard thing to understand, and when we get to amino acids, I think it'll be a little clearer. If I reverse this one more time, if I can find that spring, yes, and my silver hydroxyl. No, that's the wrong way. There's my carbon 1 coming back with a C double bond O. So to depict this in two dimensions, Fischer didn't exactly flatten it out randomly, but he put down a rule that said the horizontal atoms here are coming out at you whenever he draws a picture like this and whenever we draw it, following his lead. The vertical bonds going behind the board. And so that tells you a particular structure. Once you do that, if you force yourself to go into one particular conformation, if I had these black balls alternating, I don't know if I can change this one, then these hydroxyls fall either on the right or on the left. It depends how I built the model in the first place. I could have built the model by changing this, put it over here. It would be a different compound. It would not, in fact, even be called glucose. It's still a sugar, very similar to glucose, but it would have another name, like galactose.
So even though there's a lot of rotation in this single-stranded form, the relationship of the hydroxyls on one carbon bears a certain constraint relative to the other carbon. This will be clearer when we talk about amino acids, which are much simpler compounds than this. The fact is, these two molecules are very similar, yet distinctively different, and that small difference has profound ramifications for the function of these molecules once they're put into polymers. And we'll continue with what they really look like in three dimensions, the chair form, next time.
Question. The alpha and beta term, naming that's